Before we close, and I think Terry will have some concluding words, there are a couple of things that I think are worth sort of reflecting on, not only this afternoon but this morning. There's been an incredible diversity of talks. And I think one of the common threads is in the name cognitive neuroscience, the name Kavli Institute for Brain and Mind, which is really the attempt to try to understand how behavior connects with and flows from mechanism. So some of the talks have been at very low levels in terms of mechanism, some of very high levels. The behaviors have ranged from high down to low. But the common thread in all of them is trying to link function with mechanism. Why does a system work the way it does? What does it do? And it requires going both directions. A couple of things really stood out for me in listening to the talks throughout the day. One is the really critical role played by technology. A lot of the questions that are being asked now have necessarily involved real cleverness and creativity and ingenuity in bringing together technologies that didn't exist a year ago, certainly not even 10 years ago. A lot of that, in turn, rests on and is made possible by collaborations. So virtually every talk that we heard, and certainly the kind of research that the KIBM grants are trying to explicitly foster, involve collaborations not just between laboratories but between disciplines, so that different methodologies and approaches and different perspectives on problems are brought together. I think it's a real hallmark and a tribute to this community that those kinds of collaborations happen so readily. The amount of money that the KIBM puts into seeding this stuff is embarrassingly small, and the return has been incredibly great. And I think, again, that really flows from the fact that the people involved are incredible and understand the importance of working together. So join me, please, in thanking once more the speakers. It's been really a lot of fun and very stimulating. Terry, you want to wrap it up?
So I felt embarrassed this morning. I gave Tom Albright exactly 30 seconds to prepare his comments to introduce the keynote speaker, Irv Biederman, and I've been given about 30 seconds. But having the platform to pick up on one of the comments that Jeff just mentioned, having to do with the impacts of new techniques. So I've noticed a few of the diagrams from the book that Pat Churchland and I wrote, published by the MIT Press in 1992, called The Computational Brain, has appeared and reappeared. It's interesting, if you go back and actually look in the original figure, fMRI wasn't there. It was a big gaping hole in the space-time diagram of measurements. And that was about 1992, right? It's not that long ago. It's within the living memory of most of you here, at least the more senior people. That, you know, it didn't exist, and now we have it, and we take it for granted. These new imaging techniques are even more exciting because now you can take that down to the level of in single cells. And with computers, you can now analyze that data in a way that you couldn't. It was painful. If you think back in the time of Hubel and Wiesel, and in some labs still today, recording from one cell at a time, basically, it's going to take you a long time to get through the whole brain that way, right? At two cells per day. I was privileged to go to a meeting in Costa Rica that was sponsored by the Kavli Foundation. It was Future Technologies. And so the idea here is not to think about, you know, the technology we have here today, but what's coming up the road. And specifically, the impact that high-performance computing is going to have. Most of these techniques that I've just been talking about would not have been possible at all without the computers that collect the data, analyze the data, and store the data. And it's hard to imagine now, you know, what life without a computer, without the internet. That's the technology that we all depend on for our work every day, for writing grant proposals, for making figures, for sorting through the terabytes of data that these imaging people are accumulating. And you always wonder, where is all the data going, right? People keep, I don't think that they throw it out, right? They must keep it somewhere. it's all being accumulated somewhere on the planet, and you know, it'd be nice to have access to it someday. Sometimes the individual labs don't even have access to it because it's stored away in some format that nobody can recover anymore because the device is obsolete. Let me just give you a brief view of the future. And this was some of the most, heavy-duty users of advanced computing were there. It was organized by Larry Abbott from Columbia. And remind me, from the guy from Caltech, he was... Pardon?
Michael Lucas from NASA.
Okay.
Michael Lucas.
I don't think it was. No. There was one other person. There was three people that organized it.
There was the one.
Okay. There were several organizers, but the
Lanford.
That's the one. Stanford. Okay, Stanford, Caltech. So there are three organizers. So who were there? There were physicists who were doing elementary particle explorations, and they're just accumulating like a fire hose of data coming from these large accelerators, and they're trying to sort through all the particles and. And there they have to actually do a lot of the analysis and decisions right online, you know, nanosecond by nanosecond, because they can't afford to store it all, so they have to really be very selective. And then there are the astrophysicists who are collecting data about the whole universe, right? The space telescope, the enormous number of galaxies, and just, you know, an enormous backlog of photographs that are being digitized and sorting through it. And then the radio astronomers, you know, who are... trying to do interferometric studies, and now they have to do cross-correlation from dozens of radio telescopes, again, in real time, and an incredibly large amount of computation that's got to be done and then synthesized so that you can actually look at beautiful pictures. And then finally, in neuroscience, we're beginning to model every single molecule at synapses. It's an M-cell project that is coming out of my lab. There are a lot of molecules there, but it turns out that it's not as many as there are galaxies in the universe. So I think we'll as computers get faster, we'll be able to take on more and more and look more and more into the steps that take place following the triggering of synaptic plasticity. We're about 1 second in. We'd like to go a little further. And the technology that's going to take us to the next level is called exabyte technology, exascale. You probably heard that we now have a computer that's doing a petaflop. And it's called the Roadrunner. It's at Los Alamos, and it costs about, a couple hundred million dollars. And that's a really high level of performance that is only available now in a few places on the planet. But if you just extrapolate Moore's law, it's clear that if you're willing to wait around 10 years, it'll be in your laptop. Because every generation of computers, when I was a graduate student, the Cray computer, the Cray 1 and the Cray 2, I guess a few people here probably are smiling because they can remember those computers. Well, those were $100 million computers, too. Do you know what their speed was? Do you remember, Bob?
I don't, but it's at least a factor of 10 to a big number.
I'm just trying to remember the details, but it was like they were 10 megahertz, you know, 10 megaflops. 30 mega, and that's right. They had used very advanced technology. The cooling problem. So now you have gigahertz computers, right? So you have more power in your laptop than the $100 million computer. I think it was about 100 megahertz, you're right, megaflops. So you have about 10 times more power in your laptop right now, the people who are sitting in the room, than the most advanced labs in the world at Los Alamos and Livermore and so forth, and that's going to happen again. Now the question is, where do you put all the data? You have to have an integrated system of storage. You have to have ways of the bandwidth for getting the information back and forth. It's not enough to have terabytes of data if it takes you a day to load it into your computer, right? The memories now have gotten very large, but that's a bottleneck between the memory and the processor. So, but what that means, though, is we can already begin to see the future. We can begin to see where these new techniques, you saw the pictures, it's going to go from 100 cells to 1,000 cells, and we're going to be getting very high-resolution pictures of the brain, as sophisticated and as exciting as the pictures we now have of the universe. I was at another meeting called The Origins just a few weeks ago in Phoenix that was organized by Lawrence Krauss. And they have a whole new center there. And it was a meeting that brought together leaders in all these different areas, including Roger Blanford, who was there too, from origins of the universe, people who were looking back at the Hubble telescope, back to the origin of the beginning, the Big Bang, origin of life on the Earth, origin of human intelligence. And so it was really an exciting set of talks and panel discussions. And one of the really nice mementos we came away with was a very high-resolution picture from the Hubble Space Telescope of the deep sky. What they did is they pointed it at a little patch of sky about the size of a postage stamp. And they just kept it there for several days. And the longer you keep it pointed at one location, the more photons you collect, the farther back you can go back in time, so that you can go farther and farther back in time and see what the galaxies looked at like back then, because they were very young. It was at the very beginning of the universe. We know now that the Hubble, from the Hubble measurement of the Hubble constant from the Hubble Space Telescope, that the universe is about 13 billion years old. So what was it like back then, you know, the first few billion years? And so they gave us this giant blow-up photograph that we were all, you know, take it home with you, and I'm gonna frame it and put it up in my lab to go along with my pictures of the neurons. And I had this experience, in fact, coming back at the airport, I was standing in front of somebody else who was at the meeting, and I said, well, you don't have your tube with the nice deep space photo. And she turned to me and said, I take them. So turned out to be Wendy Friedman, who's the director of the Carnegie Observatories, who actually is the key scientist on the space telescope that actually measured the Hubble space, the Hubble constant. So someday I'm going to be standing in back of somebody who has done the same thing for the brain. And I can assure you, and she told me the story. It's really funny because we ended up talking for a couple of hours at the airport while we were waiting for a while. And she said that there was an accident that occurred. I remember the Challenger accident. The Hubble Space Telescope was delayed by 3 years because of the fact that the space shuttle blew up, and they took 3 years to fix the problem. It was the O-rings that were apparently responsible. And that meant that everybody, imagine yourself, you're a graduate student, and you were expecting to get data from the telescope, and someone tells you, well, you have to wait for 3 years, right? And so as one of the principal investigators on the space telescope, they basically had to start preparing, you know, software programs and analysis programs and everything. She said that she was very fortunate because if the telescope had gone up, they weren't prepared for the amount of data that was coming down, and the computers weren't fast enough to process it or store it. So the 3 years gave them the time to actually prepare for that future that was about to hit them. And so I think you should be thinking about this, but you should prepare right now. The graduate students who are in a lab who are recording from a few neurons, and they're thinking that, gee, you know, I can find out how many neurons are connected to this one that I'm recording from. But the fact is that very soon, within the next 5 or 10 years, you're going to be able to do that for not just one, but maybe most of the cells in a column. Who knows? It's you know, you have to really start thinking about where we're heading, just extrapolating a little bit from where we are. And it's already, the computing people are already preparing for the future. And that's going to happen again within the next 5 or 10 years. We're going to be scaling up by another factor of 1,000. Exabyte, by the way, is 10 to the, I think it's 15, 18, 10 to the 18th. So petabyte is 10 to the 15th, and 10 to the 18th. That's almost unimaginable. But it's going to happen. So this is an exciting time to be working in cognitive neuroscience, and the mind and the brain, I think we're going to have the connections very soon. So thank you very much to everybody who participated in the day's proceedings, and it was a great, beautiful day outside, but I think it was even more beautiful inside. Thank you.